Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Between the Lines podcast, everything your medical school didn't teach you about health equity. My name is Cameron Klepper, and I am a first-year medical student at SUNY Downstate.
And my name is Peter Corey, and I'm also a first-year medical student at SUNY Downstate.
On today's episode called Death Justice, we will be discussing the experience of death and dying in the United States, how there is such thing as injustice of the dying experience, and how we can potentially overcome this injustice. Before we begin, I would like to introduce this topic by clarifying what I mean by dying experience and discuss some of the current research on the topic. One can imagine that the severity of a patient's terminal illness can have a great impact on their experience of death. The more physical symptoms and mental health challenges a person may have at the end of their life, the more suffering they endure. Research has shown that there are marginalized groups in our society that are more likely to get sick and ultimately endure the suffering at the end of life based on their race, income, level of education, level of social support. But this is not the focus of this podcast. All people, regardless of their race, income, level of education, and level of social support, are going to experience death at some point in time. The topic of this podcast, consequently, is to discuss the experience of these marginalized groups in the last few months and weeks of their lives, regardless of how they got there. Medicare and Medicaid are the two biggest financial contributors of the hospice benefit for end-of-life care amongst low-income individuals. Under hospice, patients can receive basic end-of-life care from physicians, nurses, social workers, or chaplains, and they usually are required to have a prognosis of 6 months or less. Both types of federal insurance cover hospice care differently, however. With Medicare, although a patient can be guaranteed to receive basic hospice care, as mentioned, it does not cover the day-to-day custodial care that is required for end-of-life care, such as toileting, feeding, cleaning, or dressing. Medicaid, on the other hand, is the country's biggest payer for custodial care in nursing facilities and home care. Each state, however, has limits to what Medicaid can cover. Many states limit the hospice benefit to specific populations with Medicaid, and in some states, Medicaid has stopped covering hospice altogether, like in Louisiana. In addition, some states limit the number of prescriptions hospice patients can re receive under Medicaid, and Medicaid has shown to significantly underpay nursing facilities, especially those that serve mostly minority individuals. With Medicaid covering a significant portion of Americans in hospice, it still leaves millions of low-income Americans that are not eligible for Medicaid and cannot afford to pay out of pocket for private in-home care or expensive nursing facilities and thus don't receive proper end-of-life care. But why does this matter? In a qualitative systematic review of 18 research studies in 2005, Higginson and Sengupta found that the majority of studies demonstrated that one's home is the preferred place of stay at the end of life. Another study was conducted from 2003 to 2017, Cross and Warrick investigated in which groups are more likely to live at home and found that approximately one-third of people die at home, with the rest dying in a hospital, hospice facility, or nursing facility. This means that a significant portion of people end up at a place they do not prefer. This then begs the question, does every individual have an equal opportunity to reside in their preferred place of stay at the end of their life? What factors may lead to this injustice? To discuss these questions, we have with us two wonderful people that I've had the pleasure of working with, Tony Warren and Amanda Naveau. Tony is the executive director, and Amanda is the volunteer coordinator of the Joan Nicol Prince Home, located in Scotia, New York. The Joan Nicol Prince Home is a nonprofit, community-run comfort care home that provides bedside care to two terminally ill individuals who are in need of a place to stay in their final days. Tony and Amanda, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, firstly, can you please introduce yourselves and describe your roles in the home?
Sure. My name is Toni. I am the director. So I oversee our staff and our volunteers. I help out with, daily operations of the home, such as, paying the National Grid bill and taking in donations. I also do a lot of outreach and I do a lot of networking for the home, trying to get partners and donors to support our mission. We also do on-the-job training here for our volunteers, so I help with that. I'm also down here providing personal care to our residents.
Amanda.
Yeah, I'm Amanda. I have previously been a student intern at the home. I have also been the assistant director. I've also been the executive director. Right now I'm kind of here as like a subcontractor here at the home, and I help out with anything and everything from, you know, guidance with management, guidance with the operations of the home, to just doing the basic fundraising help, volunteer help, volunteer training, education, partnerships, social, website, anything and everything.
Everything, it seems like. So can you guys talk to us a little bit more about the home itself? So can you describe what the mission of the Joe Nicole Prince Home is?
Sure, absolutely. So our mission is that we are dedicated to providing a safe and comfortable environment for terminally ill residents in need of a home during their final days. So we are, like you said, we are a two-bed facility, so we only take care of two patients at a time. So we are non-medical, and we provide them with their meals and their medication, and more importantly, companionship.
So what do you think the home kind of serves in our society? So it's a very unique system to me. So is the JNP serving something that's maybe lacking in society, do you think?
I wish there were more homes like this. Absolutely. I think what we are doing for our community is so important. I think a lot of people at this stage in their life, they want to stay home. They don't want to be in a hospital or in a medical facility. They want to be in a home-like setting, and that's absolutely what we provide for them. This is a home for them. They have their own room. They have their own bed. It's very quiet. It's very peaceful. We have a lot of laughter here with them. You know, they even have their own TV, so they can watch their favorite movies. So I think it's very important to keep these residents right within their community. It allows friends to continue to visit their pastor, you know, obviously their family. We are not strict with visiting hours. Family members, friends can come and go as they please.
So the purpose of these homes, in terms of, you know, what are other things lacking and what are we providing? It's a multiple of things. I think ultimately these homes were started to assist with the hospice institutions, we'll say, organizations, because they were facing a significant lack of resources for their patients. They weren't able to find placement. They weren't able to find successful placement for them or quality places for them. But it was also burnout from having the continuous attention and need from their caregivers. So, you know, you might have somebody at home who might have a caregiver who's not necessarily educated about end of life and what to do and how to provide bedside care. So they might be calling a hospice nurse or a hospice social worker once a day. And that's a lot. They have a lot of patients to see. They have a lot of tasks to fulfill. So with the home, it kind of helps create a barrier for hospice and help protect their system so that when they truly are needed, they can be helping those patients rather than our patients, because our patients are kind of more covered here. We have more education, we have more resources, we have more knowledge with our staff and volunteers here. And then you also have the third aspect of our healthcare industry is really failing those who are dying at the end of life. There's no options for them. So there's a lot of people out there who are at the end of life who are suffering on multiple levels of quality of care, even just physical placement of where to go. Mm-hmm. Their caregivers are facing burdens and breakdowns. So we're really trying to fill in all those gaps. And we also have the educational gap. You know, a lot of medical schools, a lot of nursing schools are not providing the education on end of life and end of life care. So we're also trying to support that as well.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So What are some of the requirements for a patient or residents who come into the home? Do they have to be on hospice? Where do they have to be in terms of their illness, in terms of their prognosis?
Each of our residents does have to be on hospice service. We get our referrals directly from hospice themselves because they feel like they need our services. Whether they have an unsafe environment at home, maybe they're at risk for fall. And also, like Amanda said, caregiver fatigue. So each of our residents does have a prognosis of 3 months or less. They have to be on the hospice service and they have to have the do not resuscitate order. It's all about comfort care here. So we're not doing vital signs. We're not doing IVs, any IV meds, anything like that.
No feeding tubes.
Yeah. Yeah. No tray.
Does hospice oversees what's happening in the home, right? So can you tell us a little bit about the medical care that hospice is kind of overseeing?
That's correct. So there are medical management. They come in once, sometimes twice a week, and they're always on call if needed. We have great communication with them. We're very transparent on what's going on with our resident. And that's even with their families. We talk about everything like, hey, I think, you know what? They seem to be in more pain. Maybe we can adjust their pain meds, or they seem to be having more depression or more anxiety. We can definitely communicate that with them. So they do come into our home. They physically come in, they do an assessment and make changes accordingly.
So just like somebody would have an individual at home, where the nurses and the social workers and the chaplains and the NPs and the doctors come in and provide a plan, a care plan for their caregivers who might be maybe their daughter or granddaughter. They're doing that same exact thing here. And the staff and the volunteers are then becoming the caregivers who would have been at home.
I see. So it's kind of like a makeshift home for someone they might be lacking a place to stay or people to take care of them. So that's really amazing. So moving on to, I want to talk about kind of the process of admitting residents into the home. So in your search of patients in need of a place to stay at the end of life, what are some of the conditions you've found patients to be in? So what kind of financial situation are they in? Do they have insurance, Medicaid, Medicare? What kind of living environment do you find patients to be in?
Sure. So that varies. I mean, across the board. I mean, we've seen people in beautiful homes like ours. We've seen people in small apartments. We go out and screen them once we get a bed available. We coordinate that with the hospice staff and a family member to be present. We go out and screen them, whether they are in a nursing home or in a hospital or right within their own home. So that gets the ball rolling. We tell them exactly what we do here, that they are cared for by all volunteers, and they're provided their meals and medications. As far as financials go, we don't discriminate against anything like that. I mean, we have taken people who would have been homeless if they didn't come to us. We've had very wealthy people come to us. Living conditions, like I said, I've seen it all, unfortunately, where, the walls were studded. But then there's been beautiful homes as well. So
hoarding.
Yeah.
Being evicted from their homes.
Yeah. I think it's all about safety. You want that patient to feel safe, regardless whether they are in their own home, whether they are here. It's all about safety, and we really take pride in that here.
I see. So do patients, I'm assuming, or I'm guessing that patients often are on Medicare who are above the age of 65, or Medicaid. So in terms of insurance, do you get involved in terms of coordinating? Do they have to have insurance? Do they have to not have insurance? So what are the process in regards to health insurance?
nothing. I mean, because we don't, we are our own entity. We are not funded by the state. We don't get any reimbursements from insurances, anything like that. So we will take those who do not have health care.
As long as community hospice is their provider and seeing them, then we will take them.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, next we'd just like to discuss what are some of the benefits that you've seen firsthand for patients when they're staying in a home-like environment like the one at the JMP?
I would have to say attention. They're really cared for here, one-on-one, round-the-clock care. They're not neglected at all. Our volunteers really, you know, spend time, and us and the staff, we spend time with our patients, whether it's a quick hello. I mean, even today, Amanda did a shout out to our resident, a quick, hey, how are you today? But they're really cared for. We really try to make them feel as comfortable as they can. And we are doing activities with them, you know, whether it's giving them a hand massage or we're reading a book to them or even watching their favorite classic movie.
And I think I overall, there's, we have a campaign here at the home called the Still Human Campaign. And that's kind of how we treat each person. That's the whole positive mission of this home, is that each resident here is still a human being and they still deserve respect, dignity, love, compassion, even though they might have a terminal diagnosis and are at the end of life. So, you know, that, just like Tony said, that looks like just doing a basic, like cleaning their nails or playing a game of cards with them, watching their favorite TV show. Mm-hmm. So it's all about attention, love, support, emotional support, and physical support. Caring for all of those areas at once, which is something that you don't get in a facility because there's a lot of different patients who have high needs. So oftentimes those small little things that really matter to somebody can go overlooked.
There have been times when, I'll give you an example, people have looked for me in the home and they can't find me. And I'm just sitting there with the resident. And sometimes it's just a matter of being present, and you don't have to be speaking to them. You can just be holding their hand, or you can just kind of let them know every few minutes, hey, you know what, Amanda, I'm here if you need me. And I'm sitting right next to them.
I wonder, so in terms of, I'm aware that in other places like nursing homes and hospitals, it's kind of limited in terms of where or what patients can receive. They don't have round the clock kind of care as comfortable as they do in this home. So can patients kind of go outside? And so how free are patients in the home? Can they drink alcohol? What are things that they can do that they might not be able to do somewhere else?
Yes, our patients are very free here. We allow them to live the rest of their life. If they're able to, we do. We take them outside and sit on our back porch and let them smoke if they want to. I knew of a volunteer who actually held the cigarette for the resident. And, you know, she probably didn't enjoy that, but the resident did. So, yep. And we allow them to drink, you know, within reason. but yeah, if they want to have a sip of beer or a glass of wine, absolutely. We enjoy when residents are able to get out of their bed and come join us in the kitchen, you know, and it really feels like a family unit. Sometimes we'll sit around the table and we will play cards. We'll do a puzzle. We'll have a meal together. We've even cooked with them directly. So someone's sitting at the end of the table stirring their cookie mix or something. So we allow them to do what they are allowed to do.
They're allowed to decorate their rooms however mm-hmm. they'd like. We always encourage having photo albums brought in, having pictures hung on the wall. We've even had a woman bring in like her favorite lamp and her favorite end tables that brought her joy. So that's what they did. So we have lots of those mini luxuries here, as I like to say.
Yeah,
it seems like autonomy and dignity is something that the home kind of embodies, and ensuring that patients can do things in which in other places like a hospital or nursing home, they're restricted and they might lack that dignity, personal dignity and autonomy. So that's really, that's amazing. So moving on to another kind of topic is, have you ever experienced a patient that you feel like you haven't succeeded in helping them achieve what the goal, the mission of the home is? Like, have there any been any challenges that you've encountered with patients that due to some condition, their health condition or their family or their anything that's prevented them from experiencing death peacefully?
I wouldn't necessarily say like overall. I think there's definitely, we've had, I know I have had, I can't speak for Tony, but certain residents where you come across different challenges that you might think, wow, this is like really impacting how I'm approaching them, how I'm giving them care. And it's oftentimes like things that aren't necessarily fixable, easily fixable, I should say. But I've never had the situation where ultimately all those challenges really make it a negative experience. I think we always strive for the best. And as long as somebody has quality care and they're as comfortable can be, and we know that we've done the best that we possibly can for them and what they want, we've always seemed to have part of my words, but wonderful outcome for them. But definitely challenges along the way.
I would agree with that there are some residents that we definitely have had challenges with, whether it be mental illness or a diagnosis of past drug use, things like that. Those are challenges to care for them at this stage in their life. But like I said, I think we're always doing our part with making it as calming and comfortable and safe as we can. We've never had to, discharge anyone, anything like that. We've never had to say, Mr. Smith, come get your father. Things like that. We've never had to do anything like that. We really strive on safety and comfort. So and I think we all learn from those challenges and we can take it with the next resident that we get like that, or, another experience, maybe something like that. So we keep going.
Just like Tony said, the learning from those challenges is the big part here. We tend to find a lot of similar things happening with our residents. Like Tony touched on mental illness a lot. We have a lot of mental illness and substance abuse histories with our residents here. And those play out in such different ways. And when we've come across something that's brand new, we're like, whoa,
yeah.
What do we do? Like, yeah. Is it because of this? Is it because of this? Is it because of this? And I think we often find ourselves up here talking in the office of, well, when we had this person a couple months ago or a couple years ago, this kind of worked the best for them. Right. Or right. Let's not do this because we've already tried that and we know that that's not working. Yeah. For us,
we so don't think, give up.
Yeah, I think though that's a lot of our challenges, really, is the how I always call it, like, person and environment, which is kind of the social work lingo of how all those multiple factors in our lives, from broad factors to even the tiniest things of, like, our resident right now, what kind of lipstick she wears. All those things play into how somebody is and who they are and what they expect in their life and what they expect and how they're treated. So we really have to look into those things and dig deep into those things and therefore adjust how we're caring for them based off of those things. Mm-hmm. When you said challenges, I think my singular big challenge that I've had was I had a resident who was the loveliest, loveliest old man, had like no concerns ever, even though he was in clear pain, just so sweet. And his family was not very educated about end of life. They had a lot of perceptions, and none of them were true or based in fact. So I had to do a lot of work on with them, talking about, you know, morphine doesn't, you're not going to be getting addicted to morphine at the end of life, and morphine isn't going to make them die quicker. And that's, I think, a really challenging situation that I've had, because you never know how that's going to be taken.
Yeah, so it seems like every patient is unique, and it's kind of, as you mentioned, it's your job to figure out what makes, what home is for each person. So
absolutely,
may not even, a person could be grumpy and just not like anything, and but they, you have to figure out what makes them happy. And there might be someone who is always happy, or expresses that they're happy, and you still have to figure out, there might be little things like the lipstick, as you're saying, that they care a lot about. So moving on to, I want to get into a little bit about the focus of this podcast, which is the idea that there are marginalized groups in this country who, as you guys treat or look to treat in the Joan Nicole Prince Home, that are not experiencing death the right way, or the dying process the right way, because they lack a home or financial the necessary resources. So firstly, I want to talk about like death in general. I know it's a very heavy topic, and not a lot of people like talking about it, but that's kind of the point of this question is, so how do you think our society perceives death? Do you think do we ignore it? Do we try to do things, everything we can to ignore it? Or are there people who accept it?
Yes.
all of those things, but I think ultimately, our society portrays death as something that is very scary, fearful, and terrible. Even down, you know, we see that on so many aspects. We see that in the medical field. All of our future healthcare providers are taught that we need to treat and fix. They're never, hardly ever, I'm not going to say never, because, you know, there's lots of different people out there in the world, pay attention to that fact that sometimes it's okay, and sometimes people are going to choose having that path rather than going through the fixing and the treating. And then our society portrays it in so many different ways, right? We even, from a young age, I can imagine watching television and movies, the way death is portrayed in those, fearful, scary,
painful,
you know, something that is just chaotic and we can do nothing about. So it's really hard to have this field of work when almost all of society is against you. Their perceptions are against you.
I think it's okay to talk about death. And, you know, I'm not saying necessarily over, you know, Thanksgiving dinner, but it's okay to talk about things, be open about it, share your wishes with your friends and your family. Talk about how you want to see your death, talk about where you want to die, things like that. It's okay. It should be judgment free. What I might want might be something different for Amanda. So, and I think when we, our patients are here, we continue to still talk about death here in the home. We're not hiding anything. We talk to the family about them dying and how do they want to see it? And I think people think, oh, they're going to come in here and it's going to be like a funeral home. That's not the case at all. This is an actual home with beds and love and cookies being made and like a fireplace going. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm getting off topic, but I'm just saying, like, you need to make it specific to them and you need to talk about it.
Yeah. So it's kind of why I brought this up is because I think that because we have this perception, or the general public has this perception of death as being this, can't talk about it, has to be, it's a scary topic, that we lack our, in our healthcare system, we lose attention to the death experience. And we, because of that ignorance, that we, there are problems that arise in, you know, taking care of these patients under hospice, and how this is the reason why these marginalized groups, people of low income, minority, lack education, how these marginalized groups experience death in an improper way. So moving on to the next question.
Yeah, so with all that being said, we'd love to get your thoughts or even experiences on how death itself can be a positive experience for your residents, and in some cases, if you've ever actually seen it be a negative experience.
I mean, death in itself is, I won't say a positive experience, but the journey of death can be a positive experience, absolutely, if somebody is lucky to have that situation. And I mean, there's a lot of factors that play in into making sure that somebody's end of life journey is compassionate and positive and fulfilling. I think we really try to cover all the bases here, right down from just starting with the basics of safety and quality of care, and making sure somebody is paid attention to and always has somebody there. But then we also get into a lot of that psychosocial piece and making sure emotionally we're connecting with them, because that plays a huge role in how that end of life journey is experienced and happening, not only for the residents, but also their loved ones as well. We also focus on that fulfillment piece, which is, if you do any research about, you know, people at the end of life, this is one of the things that brings them quality of life at their end of life journey, is finding fulfillment in their life. And that can be done by passing on lessons they've learned to others, or passing on the history of their life, passing on a physical item to somebody else, whatever it may be. That's a huge component as well. And I think we do that a lot with our staff and our volunteers, and especially with the students that come to the home. We don't often have too many negative death experiences here. I mean, we certainly do have them because it happens. That's life. And people have some really difficult lives and really difficult situations, but they are really rare and far, few and far between.
With, like, I'm going to feed off what Amanda said. I helped a woman connect with her daughters. She hadn't seen her daughters in several years, and they came here to the home and they connected. She actually wrote them a letter as well. So I think that was her, that's what she needed on her journey, you know, to be with them again and to, you know, like Amanda said, pass on life lessons. I don't know what that letter said, but that's not my place. I don't know that, but that helped her to move on in her path.
Yeah. I mean, I have a negative story, and it's actually the same story that I was sharing about before. That sweet old man, his family was so misinformed about end of life and the end of life journey. He really, and I use this term lightly, because he was not suffering. He was actually quite comfortable. But I remember coming in, and this poor man had tears in his eyes because he was in pain one time, and because his family said, don't give him any pain medication. And that is when I had to, you know, really prompt that conversation of, your father is dying.
Right.
He's in pain. He's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. He's crying.
Right.
This old man who has treated you so wonderful in life and has done wonderful things in life. That's definitely one of But I mean, overall, at the end, this man had a wonderful journey towards the end of life. He was very comfortable in the end. But obviously, you think of those things and it does put a negative damper on, like, how could I made that better? I have one positive story, which I always share, I think, with everybody, because it just, it kind of like encompasses the home for me. We had a man here. He was here during the summer. So he was actually here for our students during the care program with Union College. And he was so fun. He was hilarious. He had a very difficult time in his life. We actually ended up taking him. He was a hoarder. He was being evicted from his house. He had mental health issues. He had substance abuse issues. Really not a lot of family support. He was kind of estranged from his family, but just like a good guy, ultimately, mm-hmm. who came into like just having a lot of sucky things happen to him in his life. And we did a lot of like emotional support work with him, a lot of end of life work with him. And the day that he passed, I came in. I had heard before I came in that he all of a sudden was bedbound. Up until this point, he was always outside smoking. He was always at the kitchen table, hanging out with people. And so before I came in, I was told that he was bedbound and like not responding. So I was shocked. I came in and the volunteer that was on let me know that his ex-wife was there and that his daughter that he hasn't spoken to, that I had many conversations with him about, was on her way. He actually met the daughter in the driveway and told her, like, look, your dad is unresponsive. You know, this could be at any moment that he passes. When you go in there, here's what you can do. And I said, you know, tell him that you love him, tell him what you need to say, etc. I went upstairs, not even like maybe 5 minutes after his daughter entered the room, the volunteer came to the bottom of the stairs and said, Amanda, I think he's gone. I went into the room. I could tell just by standing there that he was gone, but I put my hand on his chest and I had learned that he had passed. And at this moment, his family was sitting around him laughing and talking. They had no idea. They had no idea that he had passed right in front of them. And if that doesn't encompass like a peaceful journey, a peaceful end of life, I don't know what does. Like, you know?
Wow, thank you so much for sharing that. That's an amazing story. But yeah, so moving on to a couple of other topics now. So in regards to the process of like when someone gets diagnosed with a terminal illness, they have to figure out where to go. So it could be a hospital, it could be home, it could be in-home care, a nursing home, a nursing facility. So what do you think about these places, a hospital, nursing home, and in-home care? And what do you think is the ideal place?
Home. I think most people want to die in their own homes. It's what they know. It's where they're comfortable. There's so many unknowns in nursing home care right now, in hospital settings. I think they just want the environment that they're comfortable in.
That's not to say that those places don't have their place. They have their time and place.
Sure.
For certain situations, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it's also not everybody's time and place, like not everybody's situation. In fact, I would argue that it's not a lot of people's situation, unfortunately, but those are really the only options that are made available to people
right
in our world right now.
Mm-hmm. I see. So specifically talking about the hospital and the nursing home, what do you think is the problem there in terms of the environment and how it creates a somewhat negative experience for patients who are dying?
Yeah, go ahead. I was going to say short stint.
I mean, I can go on a rampage, but, you know, it's sterile. And I mean that as like, it's not what we do here in terms of connecting. It's sterile. Yeah, they're low staffed. It's about regulations rather than people. You know, the policies, the legislation is not there to protect the people. There's a certain way to do things in these facilities. And if you don't fall into that path, there's no hope for you. There's no way to find comfort and have that positive end of life journey for you if you don't fall into that regimen. I mean, there's countless things, but yeah. Those are the big things that stand out for me.
Yeah. So from my own personal experience, my own grandfather was in a nursing home and he would have to go to the bathroom on his own and struggle a lot. So that's kind of a clear thing that I've noticed myself. Moving on, that brings us to this next question is, what do you think are the basic resources someone needs at the end of their life to achieve a proper healthcare experience? So what do you think are the basic in terms of resources that someone needs?
I was just going to say safety.
Yeah, general safety, a safe environment,
mm-hmm.
quality care. And I mean, that's all encompassing, but I mean, essentially like physical quality of care. So good physical care, attention. You know, they need free support. Really is what they need. They need free support on many levels, which our world right now charges for any and all support that they could be given. I think they need education. And I can go back to that before I say this, after I say this other point, which is understanding. I think they also need understanding to thrive. And yes, that is a resource, unfortunately, for some people. What I mean by education, I have had countless residents say to me, I don't know what to expect. I don't know what's going to happen. And a lot of times people don't have that, especially if they're in a nursing home or a hospital and they've never had a loved one die or they've never experienced anything. They don't know. Can you imagine? You imagine not having that basic knowledge, that educational resource of just like knowing what's going to happen to you? That's what I think people need.
I agree with it.
And that kind of relates to what this podcast is about, is the idea that certain groups, because of societal constraints, they may are born into impoverished areas and family and don't make enough and cannot afford a basic living, and because of that they don't get education. So you bringing up education is interesting, because I did not think of how education can really relate to end of life experience. So in regards to morphine, sorry, did you want to respond to that, Amanda?
I was just gonna say, you know, end of life is like, you're talking about like, you know, not having access and all those things, which I think we often like see that conversation based around different like cultures and ethnicities and races. And it also applies to end of life. I think I'm sure one of you have seen, you know, that picture about equality and equity of, you know, there's somebody who's standing without a platform and they can see over the fence. The next person has one little platform and they can see over the fence. And then the third person has two platforms and they can see over the fence. Our healthcare system doesn't really give us any platform. They just acknowledge that, oh, we have this system laid out. It should cover everybody that falls short of resources. You know what I mean? And it doesn't. It doesn't. We need to be giving more resources to the people that are falling short, because they're falling short because of the society impact, not necessarily because of them themselves as an individual.
Yes. And there's, as you mentioned, there's a significant portion of Americans who don't have insurance and can't access healthcare at all, let alone being able to afford it. So there's also a significant portion of Americans who have insurance, but are struggling to pay off deductibles and premiums. So as you said,
just think of the people who are in rural communities who have no healthcare providers anywhere, or yes, might have to travel very long distances to even get a healthcare provider, even if they did have insurance or a way to fund their needs. They mm-hmm. might not have a pharmacy. They might not have the option to be getting the medications that they need. There's so many different levels of this, and nobody is really paying attention to them. So we're focusing on other areas that obviously need to be paid attention to, but we're also not realizing that these other areas also play into end of life. Yeah. And I think, again, I always say, like, we have two things common in life. We die and we're born. So if we're focusing, like, we can add all this resources and time and knowledge to being born, why can't we do that for people who are at the end of life?
100%. And we just had a previous podcast that was about birth justice. So that's really relevant to what we're talking. I agree 100% that birth should be, you know, perceived very similarly to death. But moving on, just a follow up to the resource, basic resources that are required. What do you guys think about morphine? Do you think that should be a basic resource at the end of life?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think it should be available. It's individualized. I mean, it's not like, oh, you're admitted here and let's push the morphine all day. I mean, we have to manage their symptoms. We have to manage, like, if they're in pain, shortness of breath, all those types of things. We need to educate the resident themselves on morphine, educate the families that come here, their visitors, educate our volunteers that it's not going to quicken their death at all. We just want them to be comfortable.
I see. How does morphine help patients? I know this might be an obvious question, but how does morphine help residents at the end of life? I know that it can decrease pain, but is there something bigger there that we are kind of missing in our society in terms of regards to euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide? Where do you stand on that? I know it's a very deep question, but...
I think morphine for us here is twofold, to help with comfort in terms of pain, but also it can help with people who are struggling to breathe. It will help them be able to breathe, which is very significant when you've had a long life of not being able to breathe. At the end of life, it still is a struggle, and it can be extra scary on top of being scary of the fact that you're dying. I can't tell you how many times I probably said to Tony or a resident or a family member, I wish I could help you out. I really do. There's some situations where you just look at that person and they're hanging on. It's been a long time. And I'm like, I wish I could help you out. I wish I could have it be done. And you know what? There's a lot of things that play in that. And there's a lot of steps and resources and things that we should be checking if, as a society, we decide to make that okay. But I think it should be an option. Mm-hmm. Everybody has autonomy.
Right.
Yeah, and makes me... So my uncle passed away of melanoma, and he was in the hospital. And my dad is also a physician, but my uncle was asking, he couldn't really speak, but he was asking people around him that he needed something. He was in a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. And my dad was the one who knew that he needed morphine, and he gave my uncle morphine at the end of life. And he knew immediately, my dad, from my dad's perspective, he knew that my uncle felt appreciative of that. And he was, they held each other's hand, and then he was able to pass peacefully. So I personally think morphine is very important in terms of getting rid of the suffering that's inevitable. So
But like Amanda used that example before, where the family was like, no, no, don't give them any morphine, where we're trying to say, yes, yes, we need to give him this. I mean, there's no reason why someone should be crying. You know, there's no reason why someone should be in that much pain.
Our world has forced us to believe that morphine is such a terrible thing. You can get addicted to morphine and does terrible things to your body. It will make you die faster.
Yep.
Right.
None of which are true.
Right.
But they are so ingrained in our culture and in everybody's knowledge of end of life that it's so hard to unwind that and to remind people that, hey, you know what? You don't want to suffer at end of life. If you have the opportunity to be comfortable.
Yep. And it kind of relates to the idea that we're, as we talked about before, we can't kind of accept the idea of death, and constantly family members of loved ones are trying to keep everyone alive and do everything you can to help them. So I think it's very important that we acknowledge that, we acknowledge the most important things like morphine and making sure the patient is comfortable and not suffering. So moving forward. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you also mentioned, you know, what it does, what else does it do? I also believe that morphine can, you know, ease the anxiety as well. It's going to slow their breathing down. And I think as a whole, that's just going to calm them down significantly. I mean, if someone's breathing heavy, like, you know, I don't want to say hyperventilating, but if they're breathing a little bit heavier, that right there is just going to increase their anxiety. So if you're giving them that morphine, that's really going to just take the edge off.
It's given alongside with Ativan usually too.
Correct. Those are our drugs of choices here.
Yes. you know, closing off now, I want to talk, you know, ask this question. You don't have to answer, but it's, I wanted to know if either of you have ever sought out hospice care for your own loved one and what you imagine your loved one's experience to be.
Oh, I personally have not, thankfully. As of now, I haven't. My experience with them here, I mean, it's just been wonderful. And, you know, if my family member needed it, I would call them right away. You know, if I needed some guidance or some assistance, but I have not had to.
I have not sought out for a family member, but I have had family members on it. And I've had experience of, you know, death and dying in my family. So I had an aunt. Well, a great, great aunt, she went on hospice, and I can vividly recall how that went for her. She was actually in an assisted living facility. They actually wanted to take her out of the home because she was going on to hospice, which is a whole other story for another day. But I was actually working at the home at that time. So it's not easy. But it's easy for somebody who's educated about it. And that also plays into the resource conversation we were having. We can make much better decisions and know what's available to us when we're educated about the options.
Yeah. I mean, as we mentioned, I think we all can agree that being at home, wherever you are, whatever home means to you is the ideal place you would want for your loved ones. And that can mean just family, having family around and being at home, or it really depends on the individual. But lastly, do you have any advice for medical students like Peter and I for our futures and taking care of patients in regards to not just end of life care, but in general?
Go out and perform actual physical care on a person before you decide to make the move into that field? Because how can you make a decision that big, that is that costly and that time invasive, and never have experienced it or witnessed it or even like touched another person? That is my biggest, I think, advice, is just to go out and get the experience. I always say to the students who come here, like in their early education, before they've really committed to something, like, you're doing it right. You're getting so much experience, even more than the people who are like seniors, because guess what? You're learning the basic concepts, and you're also getting so much more than that, of like how to treat somebody, how to emotionally connect with somebody, the basic expectations for a human being in the medical field. And that is going to shape the way that you're practicing, whatever field you decide, is going to shape your whole practice. And I think when you don't have that, you're easily swayed to continue with what society has already produced, which, as we've been saying, is not necessarily the best pathway for our world and the people who are dying every day.
I would say treat each of your patients as if it was your own loved one. You may not know Joe Schmo. Treat him as if, Cameron, as if it was your uncle.
Yeah.
And try to put yourself in that family's shoes. What are they going through? My thing, I think, is time. And as physicians, you guys will not have the time. If you take those extra 3 minutes to, you know what, pat your person on the shoulder, rub their head, you know, give them a hug.
Look at a picture of their granddaughter.
Yeah, like take the time, because what is 3 minutes really going to cost you at the end of the day? You might make a difference in that person's life. And my next thing is go watch Patch Adams. That's that's a great movie. Don't forget that is a person and not a number. This isn't patient A. I'm not patient B. They are a person.
They are still human.
They are still human.
I will take all of that advice to my future career.
Yeah. I know you will.
Yes.
You know what? Because you started at the Joan Nicole Prince Home.
I did. And
now, Peter, get in here.
One of the greatest experiences I've had. So that wraps up all the questions for today. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to meet with us. Do you have any social media or things you would like to promote?
Yes, our website is joannicoleprincehome.org. Our social is jnp.com, that comfort.home. That's our Instagram. We're on TikTok. We're on Facebook, all the things.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that wraps up our interview with Tony and Amanda. I want to give one more thank you to them for joining us and providing such great insight on a very difficult topic to discuss. To conclude this podcast, I would like to discuss some of the potential solutions to the injustice present at the end of life due to the significant income disparities that exist in the United States. One such solution involves making the hospice benefit more financially accessible. Not only will this involve making health insurance in general more accessible for low-income Americans, such as limiting expensive premiums and deductibles, but also removing the restrictions that are put on the hospice benefit under Medicaid at the state level. This would involve removing prescription drug caps for hospice and palliative care physicians and providing more funding to nursing homes that have recently experienced a staff shortage from the COVID pandemic. Additionally, there needs to be more funding that goes into underserved facilities that are serving the majority of patients at the end of life with the goal to improve quality of care. These facilities include hospitals, nursing homes, and nursing facilities. Nursing homes primarily serving low-income minority individuals specifically have faced the brunt of the recent COVID pandemic as it created a significant shortage of staff. Lastly, there needs to be a change in the environment that the majority of people are dying in. Although there are problems that exist within these facilities, which I just mentioned, there needs to be more federal funding that goes into a new model of hospice, such as the model of the Joan Nicole Prince Home discussed in this podcast. More investment must be given to creating a sense of comfort and belonging at the end of life, rather than a sense of fear and uncertainty. This would involve creating more facilities like the Jonquil Prince Home, in which patients can reside in what feels like their own home, receiving 24/7 custodial care. Private home care should be made more affordable for the 2 to 3 million Americans who are not eligible for Medicaid and thus cannot receive full-time custodial care at home. And hospice and palliative care must be made more accessible in rural areas and other underserved communities. With that in hand, it is our job as medical students to set the stage for this new concept of end-of-life care. I don't mean to be morbid, but imagine yourself 60 years down the line if you do end up making it that long. How would you want to experience the end of your life?